Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. About 100 years ago, an educator named Abraham Flexner critically examined American medical education and found serious deficiencies. His model, the Flexner model, professionalized and standardized medical training and has been used ever since. But today, its teaching methods, rigidity, and discipline don't take ideas of social mission, community orientation, patient-centeredness, or prevention into account. Well, my guest today has long been an activist in those arenas and in the social mission of medicine. Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen is the Murdoch Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at George Washington University. He worked at the U.S. Public Health Service, where he attained the rank of Assistant Surgeon General in the 1990s. He's the co-founder of the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship and the author of numerous books, including Plague and Politics, A Story of the U.S. Public Health Service, Vital Signs, which detailed his own survival of cancer. More recently, White Coat, Clenched Fist, The Political Education of an American Physician. And he is the co-chair of a national conference, which will take place in Tulsa May 15th through the 17th, looking at the future of U.S. medical education, titled Beyond Flexner. And he's also the lead author of a major study, which looks at six medical schools, including OU's School of Community Medicine, which are attempting to make some of these changes in the model of medical education. Dr. Mullen joins us today by phone to talk about the conference and talk about the changes he would like to see in medical training. Dr. Mullen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Glad to be here, Rich.
When we talk about social mission of medicine, can you define that for us? What do we mean by that?
Well, social mission really dates back or needs to roll back a step to social purpose. What is the social purpose of any enterprise? And then you need to roll that back. What do we mean by social? So what we mean by social, particularly in the context of medicine, medical education, is what is this doing for the society at large, and particularly what is it doing for the more disadvantaged, who in any society tend to get less advantage, tend to get less benefit, tend to be poorer, sicker, and less able to fend for themselves. And a goal of society in many senses is to try to take care of those at disadvantage. So what are we doing about society in general, what is our purpose, and then particularly for the disadvantaged. And medical education, what is the social purpose there, or what is the social mission of the medical school? And that speaks to how the medical school sees its role. Is it to train scientists? Is it to train clinicians? Is it to train doctors who will take care of people who are challenged in a variety of ways, from can they find a primary care doctor, or they're in a rural area, can they find a doctor at all, or if they're in Africa, can they get health care at all? How much of that sense is part of the mission of medicine and medical education? That is at least the conversation around social mission.
When we think of, now, most lay people, when they go to a physician, they think of a very individual relationship. They don't think of the social dimension at all. But of course, we have public health doctors and public health service. That, we would think, would involve that. But are you talking about moving this into the realm of the individual physician-patient relationship, as far as there being some sort of social mission element in that type of doctoring, if you will?
Well, yes, but not in the way you're asking me. I would say, first of all, is there a doctor there to see you?
Right.
If you're many people in the world and many people in this country, the answer is perhaps not. There is no doctor in your vicinity, in your county, in your community, or there's no doctor that you can see because you can't afford what that doctor costs in terms of the fee to see him or her. So a very first issue is, are our doctors going to the places that people are in need, and are they receiving, are they able to see people of lesser means, and are they willing to take those payments in any variety of ways? The first question is, are they there at all? And of course, in the United States, in most places, there's somebody somewhere, although it's quite irregular, and if you're poor and more rural, you're probably going to have more of a problem. But it's not alone that. If you are elderly and looking for a primary care physician today, you will probably have a difficulty finding a good one in many well-to-do communities. The way our workforce is constructed and some of the choices being made by young people going into medicine means that they're moving in other directions. So for your general care, your health and well-being, you'll have trouble finding a doctor, even if you've got Medicare or you're reasonably well-to-do. So the first question is the doctor there? then we can talk about other aspects of that practice and how that doctor is going to treat you. And that certainly is very important in terms of being sensitive, being patient-centered is what we call it these days. But the issue of the social mission isn't necessarily about changing the capabilities, the competencies of the physician. It's a lot about the values of the physician, where that physician, what sort of career that physician chooses to pursue.
Now, I've also heard social mission as far as looking at bigger issues than, you know, maybe the thing that ails you today and brings you into a doctor, but overall health, the prevention, everything from, you know, bad habits and obesity and everything like that. Does this go into this as well?
It does. The emphasis, one of the general conclusions of those who concern themselves with the nature, the value set and the skill set of physicians we educate is, are they prevention-oriented? Are they prepared and able to treat general kinds of problems? Are they family-oriented in the sense of being able to treat issues that very often have family implications, depression, addictions of various sorts, and, you know, cancer and diabetes have family implications as well. So, yes, the social mission talks about the kind of physicians we're training and what their sensitivities as well as their skills are. So that would be, after the question of where the doctor is or isn't, the question of what kind of practice the physician has would be very much a part of the social purpose that that physician chooses to put his profession to. Very often we have excellent physicians with these sensitivities, but there's certain evidence and certain concerns that more and more of our doctors, our young people in medicine, are choosing specialties that limit their work hours and specify their responsibilities, which in some ways is a natural tendency, but it leaves the broad field we call primary care generally understaffed. We have a shortage of primary care physicians today, and it's probably going to get worse if we don't begin to develop different preferences in our graduates.
I'm going to talk like a layman here, but really what you're talking about is a majority of doctors are going into specialties where the issue is, there's a problem, let me try to fix it, as opposed to let's look at the whole picture and making sure, you know, prevention, if you will, which is what a good primary care physician is probably trying to do.
I think you've got it about right. And this is not to say that specialty medicine and the expertise and pinpoint competency that specialists bring to the practice of medicine and to the problems that we as patients have isn't terribly important.
Yeah, if you have cancer, you have heart trouble, you want a specialist.
Yeah, you want the doctors going to do the best job, not have the best personality, that's often said. And that is true. Certainly when you arrive in the emergency room after a car accident, you want lightning, quick diagnostic work and surgery or such treatment as you need. But we excel, our health system in the United States in particular, excels in technology and in the associated specialty practices. And we lead the world in many fields in terms of research and creative inventions in terms of our therapeutics and our diagnostics. But that misses a large issue. As you probably know, the indices of health in our country are not very good.
No.
We do not rate at the top of any of the measures of population health, ranging from disease-specific incidences or survivals, nor do we rate terribly well in terms of patient satisfaction. And in terms of measures of equity, we rate quite poorly. So our system does not do terribly well despite the considerable expense. We spend more per capita in the United States on health care by 60 or 70% than the next country in the world. We're not talking about being just ahead of the pack. You look at the pack, which would be Europe, Canada, Japan, the developed countries of the world, and they run somewhere in the area of 8 to 11% of their gross domestic product is spent on health care, and we're up at 17%. So we're very expensive, which reflects a great deal of hospital care, a great deal of procedures and specialty care, and for that, we do not get very good outcomes measured globally, nor in terms of dissatisfaction of many people in the country.
Is that a measure of just the two-tier nature of our medical system, have not, insured and non-insured, urban with access to good doctors, rural less access?
Certainly all of those factors bear on it. The problem is that you actually observe that we have a problem with uninsured people, so that we have something on the order of 15% of our adult population is without insurance. So you could say, well, the insured people get a lot of care, and that costs a lot, and the others don't. But in fact, the others cost a lot, too, because we have a system where when somebody's in extremis, they get seen, and the costs get absorbed by the hospital or the doctor. And particularly in the case of the hospital, can't stay open absorbing charity costs very long. So those are transferred to other payment systems, running the cost up for insured patients and insurance policies and the like. So we pay the piper, but we pay them in the most expensive way. So not only are the insured expensive in the United States, the uninsured, who lay less out, pay less out of pocket, are very expensive too.
Yeah, I would think that it impacts the insured as well, as far as the amount of care they can get in extremis.
Well, the accessibility of care, very often if you're certainly in an urban area or in a medical center, is quite satisfactory. Even there now are studies that show we're getting more care than is warranted. But if you're uninsured or live in an area that's got minimum access, you have a great deal of trouble getting into the system and getting the kind of care you need, particularly in extremis, but on a good day as well.
My guest is Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen, the Murdoch Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at George Washington University. He is the co-chair of a conference coming to Tulsa, Beyond Flexner, Social Mission in Medical Education. It's a national conference taking place next week, May 15th through the 17th. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. He's also the chief researcher of the Beyond Flexner study. Let's talk a little about this study, because this is what the conference is getting at, is how we educate our physicians and again, the degree of social mission that's involved. First of all, the Flexner study was done at the turn of the 20th century, 1910, and it really was an important, I never heard of it before this conference, but it is very important in the history of medicine in our country because it really brought a degree of professionalism to physician training. And I guess it served pretty well over the last century.
It's an extraordinary document, Rich. Abraham Flexner was an educator, actually, not a physician. And under the aegis of the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Education, he undertook a study of all the medical schools of the United States and Canada in 1908 and 1909 and published in 1910 a really damning report of the quality of education by and large. Now, you have to reflect, beginning of the 20th century, the scientific method was new. Science being developed rapidly in Europe had only begun to make its way to the United States, and we still had a legacy of fly-by-night medical schools with all kinds of theories being taught and practiced, and a medical profession that reflected that. There was very little likelihood that you were going to get what today we would consider good care or care that made you better at the other end than you were to begin with from the physician workforce of America at the time. There were universities, Hopkins, Johns Hopkins in Baltimore was a new university at the time that adopted a much more scientific, rigorous approach to medical education, and there were some other well-known universities beginning to toe that path. But much of medical education was in commercial one-year, two-year diploma mills. So he traveled the country, documented this, and published this report, which resulted over the next 20 years in something over half the schools in the country closing. Combination of state boards of medicine and state health departments now being more rigorous in what they expected of physicians and licensing them. American philanthropy, at the time was very important, turned its money only to those universities that had a good scientific base for medical schools. And the result was less schools, less doctors, but he really put a quality floor, a scientific floor, under American medical education, and that has been an enormous contribution. His formula, his recommendation, was that medical education should be carried out only in research universities. And that was not because he believed that every doctor was to be a researcher, but he believed those were environments in which science was respected and taught, and that was a quality assurance instrument for medical education. Now, the problem with that 100 years later is that that has become a very narrow and restrictive definition in some ways of what a physician is or what a medical education should be. As schools have grown largely under the strong influence of research-dominated institutions, and research, of course, in the latter half of the 20th century has become very big and very important and very costly enterprise. Many university medical schools have budgets bigger than the university itself, and most medical schools have research budgets that are far bigger than their education budget. So education has taken a little bit of a back seat to this generation of new knowledge, which is an important social function, but does not necessarily produce, attract, support, or produce the portfolio of physicians, the kinds of physicians that we need to staff the country. To staff the country and meet the needs of people is quite a different challenge than staffing hospitals that are intensely specially oriented and research oriented. And in the post-Flexner era, the Flexner paradigm, as it's developed, is these intensive research universities with great emphasis on specialty and subspecialty medicine, not very friendly to primary care, not very friendly to community health, prevention, community orientation, which are values that we are arguing are post-Flexnerian and are very important.
Mm. And this requires a paradigm shift to really get more medical schools to look at primary care and the social dimension of medicine. You don't have to go any further than about 50 miles outside of Tulsa here in Oklahoma to realize there is a real shortage of rural doctors and a lack of those old general practitioners, which I know you've written a book about, the guys that could pull out your gallbladder, deliver the baby, and, fix the fever, and probably made a house call as well. We're missing out on this new generation, which for a lot of small towns was, it was a major lifeline.
Well, it's certainly an important icon of the American past, the general practitioner who did surgery, who did obstetrics, and did general medical care. I think it's fair to say now that medical knowledge and medical techniques have improved and differentiated in such a way that it is hard for somebody to be, by 21st century standards, competent in surgery, internal medicine, obstetrics, and pediatrics all at once. Now, we did have in the latter part of the 20th century the development of family medicine as opposed to general practice, which represented a very important improvement on the old model, where the family physician, of which we have many thousand in practice today, takes a three-year residency program and establishes pretty good training and credentials in a variety of activities. Today, largely not surgical. Yeah. Very few family practitioners do surgery. A decreasing number are doing obstetrics because of more perhaps because of the medical legal situation than because of the complexity of obstetrics, but the malpractice prices have kind of driven them out of that business. So today's family practitioner is a very important bulwark of care, particularly in rural areas, but doing not much surgery and a bit less obstetrics. There are happily rural general surgeons and others, although all of the ranks of family physicians, rural general surgeons, and rural practitioners are well below what they need to be in most parts of the country. And this is a challenge which is part of this renovation, a rethinking of medical education that we're emphasizing.
And, of course, your study Beyond Flexner is looking at schools that are doing this, and that includes a Morehouse Medical School, the Still School of Osteopathic Medicine in Arizona, I believe at the University of New Mexico, and here in Tulsa, the University of Oklahoma College of Community Medicine, which is just, well, the community medicine's already been there, but also there's a new collaboration with the University of Tulsa as well in this. And so how are these folks educating doctors in a new way that could be perhaps a model?
Well, happily, Rich, there are a number of schools and a number of educational leaders who have embarked on this rethinking, this sort of Beyond Flexner concept on their own, in their own schools, in their own cities and regions, around these themes as we've described them, which include an emphasis on community, an emphasis on service, an emphasis on primary care, an emphasis on rural health, an emphasis on interdisciplinary education, a variety of trends that are out there in medicine, but at many schools they are not promoted, they're not celebrated. At many schools you will have students or graduates tell you that when they talked about going into general internal medicine or family medicine, someone on the faculty would say, oh, you're too smart to do that, implying that taking responsibility for a community with all of the medical challenges that represented was not a challenging intellectually or personally undertaking, which, of course, it is. It's the quintessence of being a physician, and it's very, very tough work. It can be very rewarding. So these schools have embraced issues such as that with many exciting curricular innovations, special programs, rural placements, and we call them extramural placements outside of the traditional place of medical education in the hospital. They have twinned and linked with other institutions, community health centers, and the like. What the study is about really is identifying schools that have done that and bringing the wisdom from those curricular and educational experiences together. Because right now there is no movement. There is no, within medical education, these issues have not been articulated. They haven't been spoken for particularly well. And we're hoping from this study and from the conference that will be hosted in Tulsa to bring together in a, what we hope will be a catalytic meeting, people from all over the country, largely from medical education, but from state government, from businesses, from community organizations who have an interest in or concern with these issues, in the hopes of making them, bringing them more center stage in terms of education, medical education policy, and health policy, because we think this kind of reaffirmation of the social mission, the social purpose of medicine and medical education is what we need to deal with the 21st century and the needs of our patients and populations all over the country.
You mentioned the sort of the idea that of status among doctors, that perhaps primary care and the social mission is not that important. But beyond that, I'm sure you're appealing to idealistic and altruistic values, but financial models don't favor this type of study as well. And you look, you know, whether you become a surgeon or a the very best general practitioner or family medicine doctor or specializing in the rural area, you know, the education is nearly the same cost and the same burden. How do we begin to change that paradigm so at least there's not the sort of difference in financial rewards for doctors who are being idealistic and altruistic in their practice?
You put your finger, Rich, on a very tough problem and a very real problem, really, at if not at the core, very much in the mix of the issues that counter idealism and counter strategies, educational and practice strategies to meet the social needs of the country as described. First of all, medical students today graduate with a high level of indebtedness from both private and public schools. The tuitions of public medical schools now are on the average almost $30,000 a year, and private schools heading towards $50,000. The average student graduates with $150,000 to $160,000 of debt. That throws a pretty good wet blanket on many people's idealism, and that, of course, is a problem for social mission and thinking about careers in the way we've been talking about. Now, many things are underway to mitigate that. The National Health Service Corps, a program that pays either scholarships or loan repayments, promotes this kind of activity. It places doctors in underserved communities all over the country, and it's been doubled and will be tripled in size by federal funding over the last few years and the next few. So that will allow many more people to go into these specialties and get their debts paid down, a kind of service conditional, we call it, service for debt reduction. Many other schools are promoting programs that encourage this kind of practice, and in some states and localities, there are various kinds of loan repayment and incentives, communities sending doctors to medical school. But on the whole, primary care physicians who make roughly $150,000 to $160,000 a year on average, and that I'm talking about family physicians, general internists, general pediatricians, are looking at a salary which by most people's standards is quite good, But if you've got a mortgage when you graduate from medical school, which is your loans, to pay down over 20, 30 years, it puts a pretty good hole in that. At the other end of the spectrum, specialists on average make 2 to 3 times as much as primary care docs. So we're talking about $300,000, $400,000 a year if you're a gastroenterologist, if you're thoracic surgeon. You do better than that even. So there's very, very great pay differences within medicine. This is a problem. And the answer, of course, is bringing the floor up. We'd like to see our primary care physicians paid better. But there's also the question of the ceiling. How much should a physician be making? And many of our young people enter school not thinking about that and come out with their eyes set on very lucrative practices. And while that's understandable, when people have an opportunity, they're smart, they've worked hard, they want to make a lot of money. Well, that doesn't do good things for equity in medicine. It doesn't do good things for a sense of fairness among people going into medicine. And it definitely discourages people from going into careers in less lucrative areas, such as general internal medicine or pediatrics, geriatrics, psychiatry, all things that are very needed, very tough disciplines, and yet they're being paid a good deal less than individuals. The common saying is if you have a scope, you can make a lot of money, which means if you have a gastroscope or a colonoscope or other kinds of things, you can do very well. That's the way the payment system is arranged. Not good, has to be changed.
If you could change that, do you still feel like enough students would want to go into primary care? You mentioned the sort of prestige and status of being a heart doctor, of being a neurology or whatever, the specialty fields. Do you think if the financial model was fixed, that we could solve this shortage?
I think there's no one fix, Rich.
Yeah.
Certainly having a pay scale that is more equitable and more balanced would go a long way towards allowing people to express their own pure interests and not keeping an eye on the checkbook and the bank account. So yes, that would be a great step ahead. Would it settle all the problems? No. We train our doctors in urban areas, and many, whether they started urban or started rural, end up liking the urban area, marrying, settling down, and it's hard to get folks to go back to the countryside. There are ways, again, that is being worked on in terms of special programs, attention recruitment of more rural students into medicine, and goodness knows in the day of the Internet and you get the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal delivered almost anywhere in the country today, it's hardly asking people to go to the bush when you ask them to practice in, say, rural Oklahoma. And so I think many people like the rural life, and we'll see more people going that way. But I want to emphasize, certainly the pay structure is terribly important, and prestige, you mentioned, is perhaps in the eye of the beholder. It also is in the eye of the banker. And if the in the United Kingdom, for instance, there's very little difference between primary care doc salaries and specialist salaries, and you have no trouble filling the ranks of primary care, which are they fill at a much higher rate than we do here. So just as an experiment in the country a lot like us, you put the pay at equal levels, and you'll see people equally choose the specialty walk of life and the generalist walk of life.
Sounds like an interesting conference coming up. Beyond Flexner, Social Mission in Medical Education. Dr. Mullen, appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Appreciate the opportunity to chat with you, Rich. Thanks.
Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen is the Murdoch Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at George Washington University. He's the author of several books and the chief researcher of Beyond Flexner, a new study which will be debuted at the national conference Beyond Flexner, Social Mission in Medical Education, taking place in Tulsa May 15th through the 17th. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.